Okay, actually, I put two outlines for the class today up. Let me. Because first I couldn't, I had uploaded the outline, but first I couldn't log in. And so I wrote it in chalk, but then here's the outline I posted on the website. Okay, today we are going to be talking about the period immediately following the First World War. I'll wait for you. Okay? You two back there, could you stop talking? Second row from the end. Okay? We're interested in this issue, not just in its own right. We're interested in it because it's going to help us get at a very fundamental theoretical question. The question that defines international relations as a field. The question of how do you explain war? What makes for a stable system, and what makes for a system that's prone to war? Right? And the basic premise of this course is that we can't get at this directly. We have to get at it indirectly by looking how general arguments kind of translate into particular stories about the past, historical interpretations. There are certain affinities between particular historical interpretations and particular theoretical approaches to this issue. And so when you understand what those affinities are, and then you study the historical issues in some depth, that is a way to get insight into these fundamental problems, these conceptual problems that define the field. Okay? And what is that fundamental theoretical issue? The issue that dominates theoretical discussion in the whole field of international relations. It's all these questions associated with the whole notion of realism. What does realism mean? It's basically the idea that what's really important in international politics is the structure of power. Power considerations, not moral considerations, not the intent of particular statesmen, not whether they're good or evil or whatever. It's the structure. The structure of power that has a profound effect in shaping the destinies of great states, and in fact, in determining whether you have war or peace. Right? That's the, you know, all those claims associated with realism. Power is fundamental importance. And those ideas translate into historical interpretations, like I was saying. In particular, when you try and understand the interwar period, when you try and understand why it was that the three great Western democracies, they have this extraordinary triumph in 1918. They alone are able to beat Germany. They don't even have to rely on their alliance with Tsarist Russia anymore. And they shaped this peace, the Versailles Settlement of 1919. It turns out to be extraordinarily unstable. You know, 20 years later, a new war, in fact, a more dangerous war with Germany breaks out. How is that to be understood? Well, you know, there are certain views that took hold, that you kind of absorb from the general culture. You know, it's like, if you want to understand the Second World War, it's simple. Basically, one-word answer, it's all Hitler's fault. You know, it's like, it's the Nazis that caused the war. Everything would have been great if it had not been for the Great Depression, which, you know, struck around 1930, and the coming to power of the Nazis, you know, in 1933. You know, why is this? Because in the 1920s, Germany had been a democracy, the Weimar Republic, advanced democracy for its day, you know. Advanced a social welfare state for its day. Democracies don't go to war with each other. And so if it hadn't been for the collapse of the democratic order in Germany and the coming to power, there you, what, can't you? All right. If it had not been for the collapse of the democratic order in Germany, everything would have been great. You would have had a relatively stable system. Right? And so in interpreting the interwar period and the coming of the Second World War, the traditional notion is that you could draw a very sharp dividing line between the 1920s and the 1930s. All right? Between the 1920s, when the democratic order eventually stabilized, 1930s, you know, when relative prosperity was replaced by the Depression, and the Depression led to the collapse of the democratic order in Germany, the rise to power of the Nazis. That's, from a certain standpoint, that's the key to the explanation of why you had a Second World War. Okay. And the realist theory derives from the fact that it's somewhat counterintuitive. It takes issue with those kind of conventional notions. No, the problem was not the Nazis. You had this basic structural problem, probably having to do with power considerations that was in existence from the word go, from the very end of the First World War, and certainly from the time of that the peace treaty was signed. You know, Germany, not because of her, because she had an undemocratic political system, because that wasn't the case, Germany was a democracy in that period, Germany, for power reasons, could never accept the Versailles system. And Germany was strong enough to think that she had the ability to overthrow that system, to throw off what the Germans called the shackles of Versailles. To resume her position as the number one power in Europe. In fact, if once the Versailles system was dismantled, and once Germany was able to build up her power to whatever level she chose, given her the physical constraints on her power, Germany could be relatively stronger than she had been even in 1914. Why was this? In part because of the Wilsonian nature of the peace settlement. The fact that you now had a new state with ties to the West separating Germany from Russia. And that state is, of course, Poland. See? Russia's not much of a power factor in any case, doesn't threaten Germany in any case. Germany doesn't have to worry about Russia in any case for the time being, because Russia is still in the throes of the revolution, the civil war, and all the disturbances that were connected with that. But even after Russia began to build up her power, the existence of Poland would actually favor Germany's position in the world. It was a source of weakness for the status quo powers. Why was this? Because absent a Polish state, if there were a common military border between Germany and Poland, as there had been in 1914, then the Germans would have to be worried about Russian power. And conversely, the Soviets would have to be worried about German power. Either of those countries could invade the other directly. And that situation would automatically benefit the Western powers. Right? Because both Germany and Russia would have an incentive in making sure that the Western powers, Britain, France, ultimately the United States, did not side with their rival. Right? But this way, with a new Poland created in accordance with the Wilsonian program, a very fundamental element of the 14 points, the resurrection of Poland, if Germany moved east to attack Russia, or if Russia moved west to attack Poland, well, the fact that Poland was a creature of the Wilsonian system, of the Versailles system, the fact that Poland had all these ties to the Western world, well, that invasion would serve as a tripwire leading to the intervention of the Western powers on behalf of Poland and against the invader. Right? So what this meant was the existence of this Polish state with ties to the West tended to shield Germany and Russia from each other. And thus meant that neither of them had to worry too much about the threat from the other. since they were shielded, and therefore had less of a reason to accommodate the Western powers on whatever issues arose. They weren't worried about the Western powers defecting over to the side of their adversary. Germany didn't have to worry about the West siding with Russia against her, and Russia didn't have to worry about the West siding with Germany against her. So you can see that this Wilsonian system, the system based on the principle of self-determination, this system was not stable, solidify the status quo. In fact, empowered those nations which had an interest in revolting against it and throwing it off. Right? Those are the kinds of arguments that realists would make about Versailles and so on. What's the essence of this debate? It's like, what makes for stability? Is it moral factors? Do you look and say, well, Hitler was so evil, democracies are so good, you know, it's the replacement of a good system with a bad system that's responsible for the trouble? Well, or does it have to do with power considerations? That democratic or not democratic doesn't really matter. The power equation was such that Germany had an interest in throwing off the Versailles constraints, you know, reemerging as the number one power in Europe. Why did Germany have that interest? Well, in large measure, because any great nation wants to have some real control over its own destiny. And that means that it has to be able to defend itself, that it can't allow itself to be totally at the mercy of other countries. This is a very standard realist way of approaching this problem. But in the case of Germany, it wasn't simply that. There was also a certain moral component to it. This Versailles system, the system of constraints on Germany, the system that kept Germany down, kept Germany from fully recovering her power and reemerging as the number one power in Europe, okay? This Versailles system was justified by a particular theory of the war, why it was legitimate. It wasn't that they said, well, we won and you lost and we're strong and you're weak and we can oppose this and we're going to do it. No, the whole argument was, this is legitimate, it's justifiable because of what you did in causing the war. You're responsible for the war, and that's why you have to pay a price now, and that's why we're not going to give you the same rights as the victor countries, right? That moral judgment was in a sense, lay at the heart of the whole Versailles system. Okay? So there's a moral judgment. And then there's a kind of third, you know, this it goes a long way to explaining why it was that the Germans wanted to throw off Versailles, wanted to revolt against the system the way they could. But those two things, the power political equation, the moral factor, they're not quite sufficient in themselves to explain what happened. This is the third element. It's not the harshness of Versailles or the fact that it was tied with the notion that Germany committed a great crime, any of those things that in themselves explain why the Germans would want to revolt. I should say the proof of that, this point is you compare the 1919 settlement with the 1945 settlement. The 1945 settlement was much harsher on Germany. Germany lost about half of the territory that she had before the war. Not only that, but the eastern half of Germany was now under the control of a foreign power, the Soviet Union, which ruled through these communist police state methods and so on. This is much harsher than 1919, which left Germany intact, left Germany in control of her own destiny. Only a small portion of Germany was occupied, and even that for a limited period of time. The difference between 1919 and 1945 was not that one was harsher than the other and therefore it provoked the Germans to resist more, because they resisted 1919 a whole lot more than they resisted 1945. What accounts for the difference? It's like 1945, resistance is hopeless. The Germans begin to rearm. The Russians are going to invade. And the Western powers are so averse to having a strong Germany that they make it clear to the Germans that they better not rearm, because if they provoked a Russian invasion, then they couldn't count on the Western powers for protection, right? Germany is locked into a very unfavorable status quo because the forces arrayed against her were so strong. You know, it's that power reality that leads to German acquiescence after 1945. 1919, totally different story. 1919, what are the forces that are arrayed against Germany? It's like, not Russia anymore. Of the victor powers, three Western democracies, the Americans basically turn their backs on Europe. The British kind of half turn their backs. They certainly move away from enforcement of the Versailles Settlement. That leads France, a country which is much weaker than Germany, especially given that the war in the West was fought on French soil, given that the French suffered disproportionately greater casualties than Germany did, bled white by the war. France, a much weaker country than Germany, and thus ultimately dependent on the Anglo-Saxon powers for protection, has to think twice about whether she's going to take a hard line in terms of the enforcement of the treaty. Yes, you have this treaty. Yes, the essence of the Versailles Treaty is that Germany is kept down. Germany is prevented from recovering her power. Germany is disarmed. And as long as Germany is disarmed, Germany is vulnerable to invasion from the West. And the threat of an invasion from the West can keep, in principle, can keep Germany under control, keep Germany from building up her power. Right? The in principle, this Versailles system can keep Germany down, can keep France secure. But resistance is much more feasible in 1919, in the post-1919 period, than it is in the period after the Second World War, because there's just France. France is dependent on Britain and America. They're not going to like it if France uses force. That gives Germany a certain freedom of action to kind of chip away at the whole Versailles edifice. Right? And so realists would emphasize all those sorts of things. There's much more continuity between the 20s and the 30s than we had been led to believe. The basic problem is power political in nature. It doesn't have to do with regime type or good and evil. You know, the problem is built into the kind of structure of the system, in a sense. Right? Well, who's right? Who's right? To get at that issue, we're going to kind of look today at the problem, you know, through the eyes of the French, through the eyes of the Germans, through the eyes of the British and the Americans, and so on. So beginning with the French, what do you see when you look at the post-war world? You see that there's this basic problem. France is weaker than Germany. Absent the Versailles constraints, German power would overwhelm France. This implies that if you simply junk those constraints and you allow Germany the same rights as the victor powers, Germany would be able to build up her power to such a point that France would be overwhelmed. France would have to live in the shadow of German power. In which case, what was the point of fighting the war? You know, there's these 1,300,000 fatalities. Like I said, the male half of a generation had been slaughtered in the war. What was the point of that sacrifice if Germany is going to be relatively stronger now than she had been before the war? Right? You're not going to give way on this so easily. Right? You prefer not to have to rely on something as artificial as the Versailles system. It's not natural. It's not based on a natural distribution of power. It's based on these artificial constraints on German power that you have to enforce with the sword. Right? You would prefer to keep Germany in line by maintaining the wartime coalition, the alliance with Britain and the United States. But it becomes increasingly clear that those countries don't want to support your policy, don't want to align themselves with you in that way. Why do you find this shift in American and British policy? Well, you know, you look at the high school textbooks, the answer is easy. It's like, well, the Senate refused to accept the League of Nations. Refused to ratify the Treaty of Versailles, which contained the Covenant of the League of Nations, because of various constitutional objections to the commitments that the United States would be taking on. And Article 10 of the League Covenant, which said, you know, that all the members of the League would have to guarantee the territory of all the member states. So, if the votes of a few senators had changed and the United States joined the League, would things have been fundamentally different? America was pursuing a policy. It would pursue the same policy, whether she was in the League or without, or outside the League. Whether America was part of the League was not of fundamental importance. What was important was the nature of U.S. policy. Is it going to enforce the set of constraints on Germany? Is it going to, in the final analysis, remain committed to the defense of France? Does the United States think that it has a major political interest in maintaining its involvement in Europe? Right? The basic thrust of the Wilson policy is, America should not use force as a normal, natural aspect of international political life. American power should be held in reserve and used only when the moral issues are clear-cut. Right? You have a peace. It's based on this judgment of Germany. It's a punitive peace by Wilson's own account. He uses those terms repeatedly. But there's this other half to the Wilson policy, and this has to do with, what if the Germans resist? You know, how is this thing going to be enforced? Right? And there's this aversion to the use of force, you know, in normal peacetime political life. Right? The use of force in support of policy, well, that's militarism. We don't want to have anything to do with it. So the Americans turn against the idea that the treaty should be enforced, and they therefore call for Franco-German reconciliation, for a move away from the Versailles Peace, this peace based on keeping Germany down. As a matter of fact, they disown paternity. It's not Wilson's fault. You see this basic problem. You have a punitive peace based on the idea that the Germans have caused the war. You know, it's bound to provoke resistance. How are you going to deal with that resistance? Well, in the final house is through the use of force. But if you're ruling out the use of force as legitimate, you know, except in really extreme cases when you go all out in the use of force. But if you rule out kind of limited use of force as a normal element in international political life, well, how are you going to maintain this system that you've imposed? So you provoke the Germans, and then you say, we're not going to kind of deal with the consequences of that provocation. Right? This is you see, this is a kind of a basic problem. From the standpoint of the French, you know, they had compromised with the Americans, done what the Americans had wanted, and so on. And now the Americans are kind of letting them down. The Americans are opposed to the idea that the treaty should be enforced. They want the treaty to be revised. They dislike the idea that the French should use force to maintain the Versailles peace. The British move in the same direction at about the same time, which is to say, this begins at the very end of 1919 and goes through 1920. This shift in attitude on the part of the two Anglo-Saxon powers. British had taken a very punitive line in 1919. They were the ones who wanted to hang the Kaiser and, you know, pursue the the harshest reparation settlement and so on. Now the British say, oh, not so fast. We shouldn't really have the knife to Germany's throat. We should try and reach some sort of accommodation with the Germans. What was going on in the British case? Well, the same sort of thing as in the American case, except economic considerations loomed larger. What had happened during the war was that this massive effort could not be financed in the way governments normally finance things. Instead, all the belligerents resort to inflationary financial measures. And at the end of the war, in Britain and America especially, there's this notion that we have to return to sound money. If we want to put our economies on a solid basis, we have to kind of undo the effects of the inflation and allow our currencies to recover their previous value. So there are sharp deflationary policies that are pursued both in the United States and in Great Britain. And in the British case, this leads to an extremely sharp depression, which rivals in magnitude, although not in duration, the depression of the 1930s. Very high rates of unemployment as the monetary authorities slam on the brakes and adopt these deflationary policies. Are they going to take responsibility for the domestic political consequences of the policies they pursue? Governments have a strong incentive to evade responsibility, especially governments of democracies. And the argument takes hold, because it's a convenient argument, that all this high unemployment, all this economic dislocation, this is because of the dislocation and, you know, disarray, economic disarray that was caused not just by the war, but by the failure of the peacemakers to restore a viable international economic system. And these arguments are laid out, and it's a polemic of genius, written by by far the most important economist of the 20th century, John Maynard Keynes. He had been part of the British delegation of the Paris Peace Conference. He had observed these things firsthand, came away totally disillusioned, in a fury. He wrote this book, comes out at the end of 1919, the economic consequences of the peace, you know, basically saying, you know, peacemakers screwed things up. They could have restored a viable international economic order, but they were so carried away with these violent emotions that they failed to do so, and we're reaping the consequences, and the heart of the problem is these reparations that are being imposed on Germany, and this is just going to totally mess things up, where you're not going to have an economic system that provides for relatively full employment until we kind of clear these things up. So the British also move away. I mean, you know, these Keynes arguments, people accept all this stuff totally uncritically. And the British move away, the Americans move away. That just leaves France, right? France and the text of the treaty, which has to be enforced. And how far are the French going to go in enforcing it if they kind of know deep down in their gut that that sort of policy is going to alienate the British and the Americans, and in the long run, given that Germany is a stronger country than France, France is going to be dependent on the two other Western powers for protection. Are they going to really want to alienate the British and the Americans like that? Well, maybe not. Right. And so they are in a very difficult situation, right? What stands between them and a German-dominated Europe? Just this Versailles system, the system of these artificial constraints on German power, the disarmament provisions, the provisions relating to the occupation of the Rhineland, and so on. Right? Are they going? They can't just throw that in the garbage can. They have to think in terms of what they should do. Very, very hard for them to figure it out, to the point where they actually even contemplate maybe reaching some sort of entente with the Germans. You know, betrayed by the Anglo-Saxons, their reflex is to kind of look across the line. Maybe the Continentals have something in common. Maybe they should bury the hatchet so they could form an independent force in world affairs so that neither of them would be so dependent on Britain and America. And sounds familiar. These ideas come to a head after the Second World War, but you see them very early on. In fact, even during the war, but especially at the peace conference when the French make these overtures to the Germans, And in the post-Versailles period, 1920, when the French Prime Minister and then President of the Republic, his man named Mitterrand, pursues this policy, and they use this term quite openly, aimed at economic collaboration with Germany. And I should say a little bit about why this makes sense even in economic terms. Part of the reason is that there's a natural complementarity between the French and German economies in a variety of areas. The German economy before the war had been very vigorous, growing fast. The French economy, much less so. But the French generated a whole lot of surplus capital through savings. It made sense to kind of invest it in Germany or work with the Germans investing in third countries. And there was a natural complementarity in the whole area of heavy industry, which was the heart of the industrial economies of that period. In 1871, the Germans had annexed part of French Lorraine. It turned out that that area that they had annexed had important holdings of iron ore called Minette iron ore, which was unusable for the production of steel until 1879. But when that new process called the Thomas process for the production of steel was introduced, then the Germans had an interest in building up a steel-producing industry, constructing steel mills in close to the iron ore fields. And as the technology advanced and became more efficient, the tendency was to move away from building steel mills near the coal deposits, which were in the Ruhr near the Rhine River in Germany proper, toward these areas in the west, and above all in German Lorraine. So you have this important steel industry that grows up in German Lorraine, but it's dependent, increasingly so, on access to supplies of coal. Not just any coal, but the kind of coal that you can use to produce steel. It's called metallurgical coke, the kind of coal that can be transformed into coke, right? And this is to be found not in France proper, but in the Ruhr. And so the whole notion is, let's get together. Now the iron ore fields are back in France with all these steel mills that are built up on top of them. And there's all this coking coal in the Ruhr. So it made sense to integrate the German heavy industry and French heavy industry, the French iron ore with German coke and so on. So that natural complementarity in the area of heavy industry, which was very important in those days, fed into French thinking about, yeah, maybe we should try and work out some sort of entente with the Germans. French less likely to think in moral terms than the British and the Americans. It's kind of real evidence of the power of the realist theory that the French are even thinking in terms of economic collaboration and implicitly in terms of political collaboration with the Germans. And it's the Germans who resist this, all this stuff. Why did the Germans resist these overtures? Well, the French are making these overtures because they sense their own weakness, their own isolation, their own vulnerability. They're looking for a way out. But the weakness of the French is long-term strength for the Germans. And the Germans had the sense that, yeah, for the time being, there are these big obstacles we're going to have to deal with, but if we can just punch our way through the crust, overcome the French resistance, throw off the Versailles constraints, then build up our power, we'll be the strongest country in Europe again. There's not all that much standing between us and our goals. Why is this? It's because they know not simply the relative weakness of France, not simply the fact they don't have to worry about Russia in their east, they're protected by this Polish buffer, but also they note the dramatic shift in British and American policy. Right? Americans, they're forced to choose between their earlier notion of a punitive settlement and their aversion to the use of force. They opt for aversion to the use of force. Force is not legitimate. That implies you should be soft with the Germans, you should revise the treaty, you should aim at reconciliation with the Germans. As the Americans go, the British go to a certain degree. British move away from enforcement of the treaty, move away from any commitment to France for a policy, move away from a policy of keeping Germany down toward this whole notion of what we need is reconciliation, right? The Germans sense that France is dependent in the long run on Britain and America, that those new British and American attitudes are going to hold France back, and that Germany, therefore, has room to kind of push ahead. That a policy of resistance may meet some difficulties in the short run, but ultimately it's going to be successful. Right? I should say that calculation proved to be correct. Not all Germans felt that way. I mean, if you asked me how I would break it down in terms of figures, I would say, well, maybe 60% of Germans took that kind of line. And there was maybe 40%, especially in the Rhineland, people like Konrad Adenauer, who was then the mayor of Cologne, and eventually he'd become the chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany from 1949 to 1963. A lot of people in the German government, they said, it's not worth the price. You know, we can strike a decent deal with the French. We don't want to become a satellite of France, but we could deal with them on a more equal basis. We should understand their concerns. We can work our way to a new world through a much more moderate policy, not a policy of resistance. All right? In the words of one of these people, is when the French started making these overtures in 1920, this guy says, "We must not reject the outstretched hand." Right? The Germans look at the entire geopolitical conjuncture as well as the direct balance between France and Germany, and they're strongly tempted to a policy of resistance, although not universally so. What tips the balance for the Germans is that the British don't really support these French overtures aimed at a settlement with Germany. Okay? Where do you see all this stuff coming into play? You see it when you look at the diplomacy of the reparation issue after the First World War. What? This issue, you may say, oh, it's economics, not of fundamental political importance. It was of absolutely central political importance. Why was this? Because the real political issue here is whose power is going to dominate Europe? If the Versailles system remains intact, Germany's going to be kept down, France is going to be the number one power. But if the Versailles constraints are dismantled and each country is allowed to build up its power to whatever level it considers appropriate, Germany would then dominate France. Germany would be the number one. Right? The struggle over Versailles, which is a set of constraints, artificial constraints on German power. The struggle over Versailles is really a struggle over the structure of power in Europe. And that struggle over Versailles is going to be fought over what issue? Over just any issue taken at random, disarmament, or whatever? No. The Germans are going to choose which issue they're going to focus their resistance on. And the issue is the one that's technically most difficult to enforce, the one where the argument of, oh, we simply can't comply, it's beyond our ability to comply, is most plausible, and that's the reparation issue. You know, the Germans, if they said, oh, we are simply incapable of dismantling our fortresses, or we're simply incapable of withdrawing our troops from the Rhineland, well, that's absurd. No one would believe that. But they say, oh, we can't pay. Well, that has certain plausibility in the light of all these things that Keynes was saying. How's Germany going to pay? To pay, Germany has to earn the foreign assets with which to pay. She has to earn, you know, currency that's convertible into gold, which meant, ultimately in dollars. And but you tell me, Keynes says, which markets is Germany going to sell in to earn all this money? know, and you tell me how Germany is going to develop that trade surplus. And do you even want Germany to develop such a powerful export economy? You know, all those kinds of things. And the Germans, for their part, were only too happy to feed into and support these notions that she couldn't pay by allowing her own domestic economy to deteriorate. Domestic finances to deteriorate, I should say, because you say you had full employment in Germany these days. The inflation that had begun during the war continued in the post-war period, culminating in the hyperinflation in 1923. You know, if we can't even balance our own budget, where can we possibly get the money to pay the reparations? This is the German argument. Of course, now historians basically think that the Germans deliberately let their finances deteriorate precisely so that they can make that argument, which was quite plausible in Britain and America at that time. Right? So the Germans resist, and their resistance focuses on the reparations. What's the French attitude in all of this? You know, enforcement of the letter of the treaty, holding the knife to Germany's throat, demanding that the Germans pay every last cent. No, the French do not enforce the treaty in that way. They have all these rights under the treaty that they choose not to invoke in terms of telling Germany exactly what she has to do. Instead, throughout the year 1920, the French try and reach a business-like settlement with the Germans. And this culminates in something called the Seydoux Plan in December of 1920. Okay? The Seydoux Plan basically said that the Germans would pay a modest amount in reparations, well within Germany's physical capacity to do it, and then instead of having to pay it in dollars or in currencies that were convertible to gold, the Germans would be allowed to pay in paper marks. The paper marks would go into this fund. The people in northern France that were trying to rebuild the areas that had been devastated would draw on that paper mark fund to place orders through a central organization with firms in Germany, would then kind of come in and do the reconstruction work. A very sensible plan. It kind of took the ground out under from the Keynes argument about there was no way in which the Germans could pay because they couldn't earn the money abroad. Of course, this is all ignored in Britain and America. All right? The Germans seemed to be willing to work within this basis, the German government that was in power in 1920. You know, if you're German, do you really want this confrontation with France? Do you really want to kind of take these measures that amount to destroying your own finances, these hyperinflationary measures ultimately? A lot of Germans had second thoughts about that. And so given the division in Germany, it seemed that something could be worked out, but then the British don't like the idea of France and Germany working together too closely. And the British in January 1921, they basically torpedoed this thing. So that's the closest France and Germany come toward working things out with each other. And that is kind of drag on through the rest of 1921, through the rest of 1922. A tough nationalist, Raymond Poincaré, comes to power as Prime Minister of France in January of 22. Not a headlong rush to the use of military force, but it's quite clear that if nothing is done, you know, the whole reparation settlement, and along with it, the Versailles settlement as a whole, is going to collapse. So, with his back to the wall, so to speak, Poincaré makes the key decision in January of 23, right? This is like, 4 years after the end of the war. If we're going to prevent this whole thing from collapsing, we're going to have to use military force. And what do they propose? To occupy the whole of Germany beyond France's strength. But they're going to occupy Germany's economic jugular, which is the Ruhr Basin. This whole area here on the Ruhr River, which is a tributary of the Rhine River. And it's very important because this is where Germany's coal, the most important coal-producing area, and therefore most important steel mills and finishing industries that use the steel to produce finished products. This is where all that stuff is located. It's the economic heart of Germany, the economic jugular of Germany. You cut that off, then Germany's at your mercy. All right. So this Ruhr crisis, this leads to a crisis that lasts for a whole year. January to December 1923. The Ruhr Crisis 1923, it's the climax of the struggle between France and Germany over Versailles, the Versailles system, but also over the real question of what the structure of power in Europe is going to be. Again, this conflict between these two democratic states. What happens? Germans resist. The French requisition, all this coal, to go to France. The Germans then reroute the coal via indirect routes back into unoccupied Germany. Then the French throw up a cordon around the whole border of the Ruhr to prevent that from happening. But the German railway people and barge people, they refuse to cooperate with these requisition orders to send the coal into France. But these Ruhr workers, they're patriotic. You're not just going to let them starve if you're the Berlin government. You're going to support them, even though what they're producing doesn't get sold. So where's the money going to come for their salaries? The salaries are then paid by the government in Berlin, drawing on an economy that's weakened by the fact that it no longer has access to these products of the Ruhr. Okay? So what you have is the miners continue to work. The coal continues to build up in these huge mountains of the pit head. And finally, like in August and September, when the French, using their own people, managed to get the transportation problem solved, they were able to draw on this coal at the pit head and pull it into France itself. It seems that France had won because the issue had been defined as, would France be able to get this coal? And Germany was losing because all these measures that were made necessary by the need to finance the passive resistance in the Ruhr were leading to the destruction of German finances, the hyperinflation, the communist uprisings in Saxony and Thuringia, to the Nazi putsch in Munich in late 1923. It seemed that the whole Reich was in a shambles. Germany was falling apart, right? It seemed that the French could dictate terms. The Germans come to the French and say, okay, you win. Tell us what you want us to do. The French refuse to say anything, refuse to tell them what the Germans have to do to get things back on track, right? In a sense, France is pulling defeat from the jaws of victory, so to speak. The French won, but because Poincaré wants to allow the process in Germany to continue that would lead to a disintegration of Germany, he doesn't do anything. He doesn't tell the Germans what he wants to do. But he doesn't think the issue through because he's unwilling in the final analysis to see mass starvation extend through Germany. Maybe Germany fall to Bolshevik forces and have France as the sole continental power facing this huge communist bloc extending from the Rhine straight through to Vladivostok. In the final analysis, Poincaré doesn't follow through with that policy. And the French accept it when the British and the Americans say, we are willing to come in, we're willing to help everybody get their economies back on track, but the condition for that is that France agree to forswear the further use of force in this whole business of the reparations. France loses. It doesn't mean, however, that Germany wins. Because Germany also becomes dependent on the flow of capital from Britain and America to maintain the new economic system that is constructed in the aftermath of the Ruhr crisis. And this means there are limits on Germany's ability to revolt in a very direct way against the treaty. This does not mean, however, that the Germans have become reconciled to the status quo, or that they are now willing to live on a more or less peaceful basis with the victor powers from the First World War. Right? We move into an entirely different world following the Ruhr crisis. This is the world of Locarno, of Gustav Stresemann, of Aristide Briand, a world when people thought that now there was a chance of peace. And that's the world we want to examine next time to see how stable that world, in fact, was. Okay? So I'll see you next time.